This is 91.7 FM, WHOS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It is August, is it 22nd or the 23rd? It's the 23rd, 2017. Welcome to Bicycle Talk this week with my co-host, the lovely Fran Storch.
Hi!
A show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, please text or call at 860-486-9487, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also visit Bicycle Talk on Facebook. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you'd like to contribute or to the show or be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Whew, that's a lot. Okay, where shall I go? Let's see. Let's start with Ron's rant of the week. This is going to be a fun one. Are you ready? Fran, you're going to love this one. Your buddy, Donnie John. Donnie John. Trump administration removes White House bike share station.
It just gets better and better.
The man now has stepped on my turf. Okay. Now, I look at all the other stuff and I go, well, I'm not going to get political on this guy. I'm going to, he's our president.
He hasn't stepped on any of your turf before.
Well,
Are you kidding me?
I know, but now he's stepped on bicycle turf. This is a big deal. This is a real big deal because now the gloves are off.
Okay. So the white supremacy and the KKK and the Nazis and the misogyny,
yeah,
and the taking away health care and the taxes that didn't do that. Didn't do it for you.
No, they all did it. But now he has gone after bicycles.
That's worse than misogyny.
No, it's bad. It's bad. It seems that Donald Trump is not too keen on bike share stations. On Tuesday, his administration had a 9-bike Capital bike share station located near the White House taken away. The station, located at 17th and State Place Northwest, was installed in 2010 during President Obama's tenure. And was used frequently by the White House the Obama White House staff. Because it was located on the White House grounds, the bike share station wasn't accessible to the public and was not listed in the Capitol bike share website or maps. Despite its unpublicized location, cyclist Gregory Medleski still noticed something was amiss this week. So, this is crazy. The White House staff, let's talk about the White House staff, okay? Do you think that all the White House staff has transportation that is easy for them to access? So it's very, they all must own cars to get there to work at the White House. Is that a prerequisite? Is it a prerequisite that they can catch the bus and be there on time? I mean, or the train or the, mass transit system? The bicycle, everyone I talk to that participates in these bike share programs, like in Boston, for instance, is a classic example. It's close to us. And it's very, very available up there. They say it knocks 10 minutes off their commute because the bike is a quicker way to get there. You don't have to wait for the train. You don't have to wait for the bus. You don't have to worry about, anything not being on time, whatever it is. And you just hop on the bike and go. So the bike share programs are awesome because they put you right to where you need to be. Now, White House staff. I'm sure there's a number of people that work in the White House that don't own an automobile. They live in Washington, D.C. Why would they own an automobile? There's no point. Okay?
Even if they did, driving to the White House.
Yeah, right. Good luck trying to get to the White House.
And parking somewhere.
Yeah, and I wonder how long it takes you to get through security to go park somewhere when you're going to the White House these days.
Right.
I'm sure it's just a nightmare. The bicycle just makes a ton of sense. So... Our Donnie John has taken away the
Donnie John.
Yes, I can't refer to him as anything else. Donnie John has taken away the bike share station. What a brilliant move, Mr. Trump! What a really great idea.
You just referred to him as something else.
I did. I called him Mr. Trump. It's true. But anyway, this is my rant. So that's a good rant. I mean, how can you possibly take away something as vital as something like that. So anyway,
Nothing surprises me anymore.
So Donnie John, open your eyes. We're tired of your you know what, and we would rather you didn't become another one of the many bike haters out there, because that kind of you just kind of put yourself in that category. So anyway, speaking of bike haters, I did a rant last week about e-bike haters. Get over yourselves. And I have a follow-up on that because I got some comments. And I thank you very much for comments, by the way. These comments came through my Facebook page, and I do appreciate that. Remember, Bicycle Talk on Facebook. You can comment anything. I will respond. So anyway, this was from Bruce Masterson. Hello, Bruce, if you're listening. I know you're listening because you said you listen to the show often. I'm going to do a little shout-out to you. Bruce was originally a University of Connecticut attendee, and he is also from Rhode Island. He is also a cyclist. He also worked at Rainbow Cycle many years ago. And he said in Rhode Island, most of the e-bikes he sees are the throttle models, like the Pedego electric bikes and mail-order bikes that don't require any pedaling. These are mopeds and do not belong in the bike paths. I see a gentleman riding around the city against traffic at 20 miles per hour most mornings on my way to work. Not a bicycle. Now, Bruce lives in the Providence area, Providence, Rhode Island area. So he says, not a bicycle. Now, I think he's referring to the bicycles that are, there are a number of bicycles that you can either be pedal assist or so there are some that are just motorized, and that's it. And so he makes a strong point here. So let's look into this. So I responded back to him and thanked him very much for contacting me. And he responded back with, it is a tightrope that the industry will have to navigate. I rode a pre-production Specialized this weekend, and it was remarkable. Almost too fast. Great for an experienced cyclist for commuting. I would have reservations about putting a less confident rider on one. So these things, they move. There's no question about it. You can go easily 20 miles an hour on an electric assist bicycle. So if you're not used to riding at 20 miles an hour, if your pace is normally around 10 to 15 miles per hour, it brings up the corners a little quicker. It brings up everything a lot quicker. So you really do have to pay attention when you're on one of these. And should you be on a bike path? It's a good question because, you know, if you take a look at like the state of New York, New York City had they were pulling over and ticketing people that were on electric bicycles because they were not registered motorized vehicles. Now, there is a line there. There is a speed average mile per hour or something like that, I believe is the way it works. As far as where the restriction is, it may be different in different states, but once you exceed a certain mile per hour, I believe that number is close to 30. Maybe I'm wrong. Someone can correct me on that if they'd like. Then you are now a motorized vehicle. So a lot of times these vehicles are governed down to be at a point where they can only go so fast. And therefore, they're not an official motorized vehicle that needs to be registered. So anyway, a little response back on the bike hater and the bike hater rant from last week. And thank you very much for Bruce for listening. We really appreciate your feedback. And please send me more. I love it. I just love it. Moving on from that point right there, it seems like I had another. I was like full of rants this week, but I'm gonna move away from that for a while. We're gonna go back to on the positive side. This is the point where we talk about something positive that's going on, and I am going to put a couple of things in here. First of all, last Saturday was the Steeplechase Bike Tour, and we had a lot of people show up to it. It was a great time. We had wonderful, wonderful weather.
Yes, so, it was.
On a positive side, a shout out to all of you who participated in the Steeplechase Bike Tour.
Thanks.
You're Fran participated in the Steeplechase Bike Tour.
I participated in the bike tour.
She did. Have you cleaned off the nail polish on your nails yet?
No.
No. So she did the 100-mile ride, so she got the the trophy of at the Eastford rest stop, you get your nails painted.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a thing that happens.
Yes.
But there were a lot of people that did it, and our largest numbers were in the 100K ride. That was, seemed to be the biggest ride out there. But just everyone seemed to have a great time. We had good participation. Numbers were not exactly where we wanted them, but a huge, huge shout out to the Jeffrey Piasson Foundation, who was kind enough not only to be our title sponsor on this event, but also they doubled every donation. So for every dollar you gave to the steeplechase, they doubled it, which was really, really special and really kind of them. So that's a little more on the positive side. I have one more on the positive side. A shout out to our good friend and local professional athlete, Amber Pierce, who won the Tolkienique Classic.
She did. Is that so exciting?
Yes, she did. So I saw her at the steeplechase because she and David showed up to ride the steeplechase. And I asked her how she did. And she just beamed and looked at me and said, "I won." And it was just that's really cool. So, yay, Amber. Good job. Good job.
Rode with Amber on the steeplechase.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was riding with her husband, David, and we were coming back from Baltic. And so we were on the Baltic Hanover Road. And all of a sudden, I see this woman come around me, and it's Amber. And I'm incapable of just saying her name, Amber. I screamed like a fangirl. And so she came.
You're
and,
a groupie.
I am. And so she came and she rode with us and chatted with us. And your friend Milton had affixed a camera to her bicycle. So she went ahead of us a little bit so she could film us. And that was kind of fun. And then she chatted with us and she rode and chatted with various of us. Sometimes she was with me and sometimes she was with Martin and Lance. And big shout out to Martin Summer and Lance Minkler, who rode with me the whole way and were absolutely lovely, terrific companions. We were the Lanterne Rouge because, you know, you didn't have so many people doing the sentry.
Yeah.
And we aren't as fast as the other people.
And you like to schmooze.
And that's the other thing. We spent a lot of time. We spent a lot of time at the rest stops. And Martin wanted to have his nails done. So the interesting thing about Martin is that he had his nails done. He had daisies put on his thumbs.
Yes.
Because.
And why would he do that?
Because Heather Heyer was the woman who was killed in the Charlottesville rally.
Mm-hmm.
And he noticed that in all of the all of the memorials to her and all the things that things that she
posted,
liked,
right,
and posted, mm-hmm, she seemed to like daisies. Daisies were her favorite flower. So he saw a lot of daisies. So he decided to put daisies on his thumbnails in her honor, because we were doing something, instead of doing something awful like what the protesters were doing, we were doing something positive. We were doing something for the community that was a community gathering thing, and to support people less fortunate than us in the community.
Exactly.
So we were doing the opposite of what the white supremacists were doing in Charlottesville. So,
well, that's good.
He honored Heather Heyer that way. It was very sweet.
That is.
And then we had a nice gentleman with the sag wagon, and he saw us at Eastford, and he said, "Are you the Cowtails?" And I guess we're the Cowtails. So Lance thought that was hysterical.
That's pretty funny.
And so now we're considering getting cowtail jerseys because we're the end of the line.
Oh, you could have a head on the front and then the tail on the back.
Sure,
you get the front of the cow and the back of the cow.
You have a cowtail
Very nice,
jersey.
Nice idea. Maybe we'll have to look into that.
Right.
That looks like fun.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So anyway, steeplechase, very good. Fran did great. She did 100 miles. Good for her.
I cramped a little.
She cramped a little. Yeah, things like that happen. It happens.
And Lance and Martin took care of me. They were great.
They did.
And I drank pickle juice.
And as far as on a positive side, big thumbs up to those who take care of others when doing long rides.
I drank pickle juice. I was mid-cramp, mm-hmm, and I had a flask of pickle juice with me, and I drank it, and it aborted the cramp. So it aborted it first in my left leg, mm-hmm, and then my right leg started to cramp. I drank pickle juice, and it took it away.
Okay, Miss Naturopathic Physician, why does pickle juice work so well?
Well, here's the thing. So you've brilliantly designed this ride so that there is a horrific hill at mile 75, County Road in Woodstock. Beautiful, beautiful road. It's really delightful. But it's a 7-step hill, and it's relentless. And it's at mile 75, and you do it at the hottest part of the day, and it was a hot day. And I sweat a lot. I am a person who sweats mm-hmm. a lot. I'm guessing that I sweat more than Martin and Lance. Because I certainly had the fitness to do it. I got over the hill no problem. That wasn't the problem. And Coach Aaron said to me, what happened to you was not a fitness issue. Cramping right. is not a fitness issue. Right. It's a time in the saddle issue.
Yes.
Just some people, it just happens, and it can happen to anyone at any time.
It sure can.
And so so I got over the hill, and then the next road you have to do is Bungie Hill. And, of course, and I was thrilled. It was not cramping on or after County. Then you do Bungie Hill, and you have to schlep up Bungie Hill. And right after the first schlep is this beautiful, brilliant, sweeping descent. It's one of the best descents in the area.
Another reason why you ride a bike.
It's so wonderful.
Right. Exactly.
So then you finish that descent, and then Bungie Hill kind of does a bunch of rollers and up and down mm-hmm. and up and down. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, finally you finish Bungie Hill, and then you turn right onto 198. And you have to go north on 198, so mm-hmm. you're actually going uphill.
A little bit. Yeah.
It's a little bit of a grade there.
It's not
maybe,
for long.
Maybe 1%. And then you turn left to get onto Center Pike and make your way to Eastford Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm totally fine. We get to Eastford Baptist Church, and then we have a nail painting party.
Mm-hmm.
And that took a long time. Probably took half an hour or maybe more. I don't
know. Pickle juice? Any pickle juice yet?
Nope.
Not yet. Okay.
No cramping yet.
All right.
That's why. So we did that whole thing, and I drank tons at the church, and I put Gatorade in my bottle and took more electrolyte pills, and then we did the whole Boston Hollow deal. We did the Boston Hollow, dirt, and climbed up Boston Hollow and got on 289. Well, 2 miles in, probably when I was just about to Route 44, that's when the cramp started to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was actually descending, spinning, and that's when it started to happen. I was so, and the thing was, I wasn't bonking. I had a lot of energy. I felt fine, and my legs started to cramp, and I was so upset. And, you know, Lance and Martin were like, you want to stop? We could stop for a little bit. I said, let me not stop. I have a pickle juice flask. I fished it out, and I started drinking it. And first the one cramp stopped, and then the other one did. So why that
so
happens?
So the question was, why pickle juice?
Why? Because, well, the thing is, I probably was pretty tapped out electrolyte-wise anyway, so I was probably low in my, you know, electrolytes and salt and magnesium, potassium. And so it was more likely to happen. But the other thing is that all that repetitive motion causes your nerves to overfire. So your nerves don't want to stop firing. That's really where the cramp is coming from. It's the nerves are irritated, and they don't want to stop firing because you've been pedaling all day. And so the overfiring of the nerves causes the muscles to seize up. So if you can get the nerves to quiet down, you can make that stop. So pickle juice, it's not just because it has salt and vinegar and an easy delivery system for the salt that's in it. It's because it can't be explained because of how fast it's worked. It works. You're not going to absorb the salt that fast. So what's going on is you're tasting that intense vinegar and salt, and it interrupts the nerves. It interrupts the nerve cycle. So it gives a shock to your nervous system, so it stops firing excessively. And once I had those two cramps, a combination of things. One is that I had the pickle juice and the cramping stopped, and then Martin and Lance backed it down a little bit so that I could find a spin that worked so I wouldn't cramp again. And then I didn't cramp again the rest of the ride, not even on that last climb on Conantville that we love so much at mile 102.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So pickle juice for cramps.
Right. Right. It seems to work.
Yeah.
Seems to work. And it's like immediate, too.
Yes.
It really, really kicks in right away. And cramps can happen. And, you know, you think normally a cramp would happen like, you know, when you're climbing a hill or something like that. But that's not necessarily the case. I have had cramps while climbing hills. I have definitely had quad cramps while climbing a hill. But I've had more cramps on flat road. than I have on hills.
Because of the repetitive motion.
Right.
Sometimes I'll cramp. So say you're way into a ride and it's a hot day or whatever, and you're way into a ride and you're descending. So I descend with one knee up. I'll get hamstring cramps in the leg that's still.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That doesn't surprise me either. Yep. I think I've had the same experience.
I don't get quad cramps. I get hamstring cramps and adductor cramps.
So it happens. It definitely happens.
Yeah. And to anyone.
Cramps happen. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible thing. So anyway, but you survived, and the steeplechase was good, and we all had a good time, which was great. So one of the things that's going on right now in the world, if anyone is paying any attention whatsoever in cycling, is we are now, I think, into our fifth day of the Vuelta España.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
Oh, for goodness sakes, yeah. And I do believe I saw that NBC Sports is going to be broadcasting that, so we might want to keep our eyes open on that one. I also sometimes will watch it on my...
Steep Hill.
On Steep Hill also. So Steep Hill TV is another place you can go for it. A lot of fun. Or you can just, you know, peruse the internet like I have. And you can find anything. Cyclingnews.com, www.cyclingnews.com, has a lot of information. And that's /Vuelta-a-España. So anyway, there's just a little bit of information here about the Vuelta. The Vuelta España started in 1935. It is the Spanish answer for the Giro d'Italia or the French Tour de France. So we're talking about their major Grand Tour, and it has been around for quite some time since 1935. So it was prevented from being run by the Spanish Civil War and World War II. So it did have a little bit of a break in the early years of its existence. However, the race has been held annually since 1955. So steadily now since 1955, that'll be 62 years. As the Vuelta gained prestige and popularity, the race was lengthened and its reach began to extend all around the globe. Since 1979, the event has been staged and managed by Unipublic until 2014. And then blah, blah, blah. There's lots of information along this. So along with the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia, the Vuelta makes up cycling's prestigious three-week-long Grand Tours. While the route changes every year, the format of the race stays the same, with the appearance of at least two time trials, the passage through the mountain chains of the Pyrenees, and the finish in the Spanish capital of Madrid. The modern editions of the Vuelta España consist of a 21-day-long segment stages over 23-day period of time, which includes two of the rest days. So it's very, very similar to the Giro and to the Tour de France. Big mountains, really, really, really hot. Every tour has its thing. Now, the Tour de France can have some really hot times too, but the difference between the Tour de France and the Vuelta, I think, is the openness of the Vuelta. It's really it's almost like you're in high desert. It's just there's no trees anywhere.
The south of France is even with North Carolina, and you're right. There's some desert-like conditions there, but it's at the 35th parallel. It's almost subtropical.
So get this.
The south of France, the south of Spain.
Yesterday's stage four, it was 37 degrees Celsius.
Ooh, not good.
That's 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
So talking about these guys are riding in 100 degree weather. Just brutal, 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 brutal. So it's, it has a different aspect. Tour of Italy, the Giro d'Italia, they'll ride through snow. Okay.
Right.
The Tour de France, they get a little bit of a mix of everything. You know, the weather can be damp there. They can have some problems with that. The Tour of Italy also doesn't rain during the Vuelta. It's like, I don't know if it ever rains in Spain in August. So it's, I don't know how that works, but it's a very dry and arid area. And until you get up into the mountains, you don't get cool. And even there, you don't get real cool. But I think that the Vuelta and the Giro are probably the two hardest races of the multi-day stage races in the world. And I think that the Vuelta is, in comparison to the Giro, just in the fact that it has different aspects to it, being the heat, being the severe climbs. We're talking 20% grades on some of these climbs. It's tough. It's a really, really tough one. So the organizers of the Vuelta a España continue to provide a punishing punishing rides for the final Grand Tour of the season. The 2017 edition is packed with summit finishes, including the legendary Angliru on the, I don't know how to spell it, penultimate stage. Anyway, the mountains begin early with the stage three traversing Andorra en route from the opening stages in Nimes for the first stage on Spanish soil in Catalonia on stage four. It's not going to be a beach holiday for the bunch, however, as a transfer to Valencia sees another lumpy stage and with a Category 3 finish on stage five. The serious climbing comes at the end of the second week as the race heads into the Sierra Nevada with two major summit finishes before the second rest day. An 800-kilometer transfer awaits the riders after this test, and then they fly to the other side of the country, to Logroño, for a flat stage, and then two minor summit finishes, stage 17 and 18, and one lumpy stage leading into the decisive finish.
Chris Froome is in the red jersey?
Chris Froome is in the red jersey now. Yes, he is in the red jersey.
Oh, that's redonk.
So, yeah, he's there by a solid 2 seconds.
Whoa!
So it's not like he's that, you know. David De La Cruz from Quickstep is right behind him, 2 seconds behind, as is Nicholas Roche. And TJ Van Garderen from the U.S. BMC Racing Team is in fourth place, also 2 seconds behind him. And Vincenzo Nibali from Italy is 10 seconds behind. Johan Esteban Chavez Ribeiro from Colombia is 11 seconds behind. And Fabio Aru is 38 seconds behind. He is the Italian champion. Adam Yates is 39 seconds behind. They're all very close right now. It's early. It's stage five today. Stage five is a 175.7-kilometer stage. There are some interesting climbs on here. I see a category, starting with a category two, dropping back down another one at category three, followed by another two, followed by another two, and then it looks like a pretty major downhill sprint towards the finish, but there is a wall at the very end, and I'm talking at 172.3 miles. Look at this. There is a wall. It is a category three. It's real steep. So I can only imagine how steep that is. It's probably a 20%er. So if you're a Fabio Aru fan and he is in the running at that point, watch that guy climb on the real steep stuff. He's like fascinating to watch. He has the ability to turn over big gears at high RPMs on super steep climbs. So I'm kind of hoping that if he stays in with them at the end, that he's the one there, because he could show us that little dance that he did in the Tour de France, which was pretty impressive. So anyway, that is the Vuelta a España, and that is that's kind of an exciting time right now. And if you're into the whole bike racing thing, it's definitely there. So we have other things. So I'm flipping around and I'm finding different things, and there's an article that was in Time Health, the Time Magazine Health, and it says why you should rethink your spinning obsession. So, you know, I know this is a big flip from bicycle racing to inside the spin room, but I am a certified spinning instructor and I've been teaching for 14 years, and I don't entirely agree with all of the techniques that are used on the spin bike, especially the Soul Cycle folks. They just don't make any sense to me whatsoever, and all they do is make you spin really, really low gears at really, really high RPMs, and I don't see the point. So anyway, the comment here, this is from Time Health, from Time Magazine. Spinning might look the same as outdoor cycling or riding a stationary bike, but in many ways it's far more intense workout and one of the easiest to overdo. First, there aren't many, if any, breaks in spin class. Take my spin class, there are always breaks in spin class because I teach more of an indoor cycling class than I do a quote-unquote spin class.
This sounds like a generalization.
I never generalize.
Never.
When you're biking outside, you have to be aware of road dangers like water and cars, and so you have to slow down at many times. So anyway, they're talking about how in spin class, though, you'd never really let up. So I will agree with that, but it is also most spin classes, I will say, are over with. The intensity part is over with in 40 minutes. So, you know, yeah, you're going to go out, you're going to go hard, you're going to work real hard. That's the way it is. The muscles that you use in a spinning bike, the gluteus maximus and the quadriceps, are some of the largest in your body, so you're using a lot of energy. And you can burn up to 600 calories in an hour, so it's a very efficient exercise. So it puts spinning near the top of the list when it comes to high-intensity workouts. A study from Sweden found that 1 hour of spinning was enough to trigger the release of blood chemicals associated with stress, heart stress, or changes. While that may sound like a bad thing, these blood chemicals or biomarkers signal the heart that the heart is getting a good workout. These kinds of findings also have been seen with prolonged exertion, such as marathons. So anyway, this is all good stuff. So why are they feeling like this is such a terrible thing? the low-impact nature of spinning makes it a great exercise for older adults. I guess I qualify for that. But it's also easy for people who are new to spinning to overdo themselves and overexert themselves. If you're not used to the vigorous exercise or to exercising the large lower body muscles involved in spinning, you can overdo it. So this is where she has found that some of her research has linked spinning to, oh boy, things I cannot pronounce.
Rhabdomyolysis.
Rhabdomyolysis.
Yeah,
what
she's
is
saying
that
you can get rhabdomyolysis in spin class.
So talk to me about this.
I've never seen it.
No.
So rhabdo is the thing that they're afraid of. Rhabdo is often associated with CrossFit. What it is, what rhabdomyolysis is, it's a, when you push your muscles too hard very suddenly, you can get a sudden breakdown of muscle tissue. And what happens is in this breakdown, you spill, so you have a protein, you have a protein in your muscles called myoglobin. It's similar to hemoglobin. It carries oxygen to the muscle cells. And myoglobin, so your muscles become inflamed and they open up and they dump a whole bunch of myoglobin into your bloodstream. And your kidneys can't handle that amount of myoglobin. All of a sudden, it can shut them down. And that's called rhabdomyolysis. So the thing, you see that more often in high-intensity resistance training, but this is suggesting that if people work too hard too fast, if you don't train properly, if you don't warm up and cool down properly, and if you go from 0 to 60 in your training, just like if you know how what we always say, you increase by 10% per week.
Right.
If people go too hard too soon, they are more at risk of that. And that's what they find with CrossFit and all the other exercises too. It happens when people, they go too hard too fast. They go beyond what their body can handle and too hard too soon. I'm a little concerned about this article because this article is going to scare people away from spinning altogether.
Exactly. But she also says people have swollen legs or trouble walking, and sometimes they take aspirin for muscle pain, which is the last thing they should do because those can also damage the kidneys. So it's probably if your legs hurt after you did a hard exercise, then you need to go easy the next day.
And do other things. Stretch.
Do other things.
Drink
right.
lots of water. Take magnesium. Roll them out.
Do upper body work
yes.
the next day, not the lower body work. Do something that is, not the same as what you did the day before. So it says here, while overexertion is possible with any form of exercise, she says the risk during spinning may be higher, especially when you consider that some spinners lose up to a liter of water in an hour-long session.
Bring two or three water bottles with you.
A couple of water bottles with you. What's the big deal here? So anyway, you know, as with any article, they it is one person's opinion.
And also, it's articles like this it annoys me because it's going to make some people who are on the edge about, because my problem is not that my patients are going to spin class and working too hard. My problem is I can't get them out the door for a walk for 10 minutes.
You got to get him in there to do it in the first
place. So she's going to put out an article, say, well, if you're going to exercise, don't spin because you're going to get hurt. Thanks.
Right. So anyway, so we're not real keen on this idea and this article right now.
And I'm sure that there are some people who have gotten rhabdomyolysis from taking spin class, but I've never heard of it. I have heard repeatedly about people getting rhabdomyolysis from high intensity resistance training, weight training.
Right. So that can happen. Right. So anyway, we're going to kind of disregard this article then.
I don't think you should disregard it. There are some good caveats. There's another piece to the NSAID thing. If you take an NSAID, you know, an aspirin or an ibuprofen to prevent the pain from your legs, you're not going to be able to tell what's going on.
Right.
So if your legs really hurt, you're going to not feel the pain. And pain is a signal to tell you that something is going on.
Exactly.
It's better to take care of it. Stretch, drink your water, go easy, all those things that you said. But taking the aspirin, you're going to be more likely to get your rhabdo because you're going to push yourself harder because you can't feel the pain.
Right. Exactly. So anyway, and as I tell everyone who comes to me and talks to me about spinning, and they have questions about it. I actually had a woman this morning. She said, I was planning on coming to your spin class this morning, but I chickened out at the last minute because you guys are too hardcore. No, we're not too hardcore. It's not us. You are the one who makes it hardcore. And I tried to explain that to her, that she was in control of her bike and that I didn't go around and push the levers forward or turn the knobs up or whatever you do that makes it so hardcore, that it's your workout and you do your workout the way you want to do it. I am just there to instruct. I am there to guide you through it. And any good spinning instructor or fitness instructor will be the same way. They will evaluate the person they're working with and they will only have them do what they can do. Remember, you are in control here, not me. So anyway, that's another thing that I strongly encourage with people is make sure you have an instructor that warms you up properly. Because if you, I spend more time warming people up than most instructors do. And this 2 or 3 minutes of warm up and then dive into the class is just, I just find that to be somewhat absurd. So you're going to spend 10 minutes warming up with me at least. And once I get you there, then we're going to work really hard. But I'm going to make sure that you are sufficiently warmed up. So every instructor is different, and you find the instructor that works best for you. If the instructor that works best for you is someone who only warms you up for 3 minutes and then you dive right into it, go for it. That's fine. But I'm not that person. So find an instructor and be sure to ask your instructor very carefully, you know, what is it that you do? How do you do it? I'm a little, you know, if you're intimidated by it, if you're nervous about it, please don't be. Just ask. You get a lot of information if you just ask. That's the key. So anyway, moving beyond that, I think spinning is a great thing. I think it's kept me on my bicycle all winter long for 14 years now, and it has allowed me to hit the roads with a little more fitness too to start out with. You're shaking your head. What are you looking at?
I'm looking at this New York Times article that's saying that between 2010 and 2014, there are 29 emergency room visits for exercise-induced rhabdo at New York Presbyterian.
Wow.
And weightlifting, CrossFit, running, and P90X were the reasons for some visit, but most of the visits were spin classes.
No way.
But this is in New York City.
So they're doing SoulCycle.
Probably. You're calling out SoulCycle.
I am.
Yeah.
So, I will call it out all day long.
Well, all right, but it may not have been SoulCycle. It may have been, and it doesn't say that. may have been SoulCycle, it could have been something else. And there are other, indoor. So this is interesting. They're using spinning with a small s. Spinning is
right, because it's copywritten. It's
copyrighted by Mad Dog. That's right.
It's trademarked.
Yep. And yet they're going ahead and using it. And mm-hmm. I don't know if Mad Dog saw that, if they would do something about that.
Well,
I think they
should.
Because because you could say that they're giving the idea that spinning, Mad Dog spinning, is causing the rhabdo. And what it says is this woman went into a class and spun fast to favorite workouts. It is likely, because she was in New York City, it could have been SoulCycle or something like it. And there
sounds
are other,
like it.
There are other, because that's a popular thing to teach those routines where you're doing to really hard music and you're spinning really fast. And to somebody who's not trained, to push them like that,
right,
is going to be more likely to cause rhabdo. And if you're in New York City, you're probably not playing to outdoor cyclists. You're playing to people whose spinning is their exercise.
Gym crowd, yeah.
Right.
Different crowd.
So they're going to be less fit, less consistent, and more likely to get the rhabdo.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Well, that's unfortunate. And it's, you know, I don't know what to say.
It's what you said, that when you teach your indoor fitness classes, you do proper warm-ups. You always say to people, if there's something that's hard for you, you don't have to do it. This is your class.
Mm-hmm.
You work at a level that works for you. Make sure you increase your intensity slowly over the course of days or weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And don't push yourself so hard that you make yourself sick. I mean, you say all those things.
I do.
You warm people up and cool them down.
I do. I think it's really important. And so anyway, if you spend a spin class with me, you will probably end up spending a full hour by the time you get done, by the time I warm you up and cool you down.
That's right.
But there will also be a sufficient amount of time to warm up and cool down and stretch afterwards, too, which is really important. So anyway, not all spin classes were created equal. they're all a little bit different. So that's something to be aware of. And you know, you have to be careful with your fitness. You always have to be really careful about and cautious about not going too hard, too soon, too fast, too long. I go over the twos. We'll call it the twos, the two problem. And see this all the time. I see this all the time in outdoor cycling too. I see it in outdoor running. I see it in people that do triathlons. This is not an unusual situation that people just get a little over their heads very, very quickly and easily. So
a spin instructor responded to this article. You want to hear what she said?
Oh, I would love to hear what she said.
Okay, so this nice lady named Barbara Peterson, she wrote in. She's from Washington State. She says, I provide spin classes to people of all ages, including those over 75. I'm 67. Spin can be such a great exercise for getting blood flowing, but the truth is each participant must have his or her own goals and stick to them, regardless of what I or another instructor urges him or her to do. I'm a 67-year-old instructor teaching twice a week. I take other instructors' classes two times a week for my own fitness. For those in my class, dial up if you need it. Ignore my entreaties if you don't need it. Instructors have a job to inspire the class to challenge themselves. Participants need to be comfortable avoiding or ignoring my boot camp barkings. And that is the responsibility of the instructor, to empower the audience to use the 50-minute session to reach their own goals.
What a great response.
Wasn't that well said?
Yeah. Really well done. Really well done.
Yeah.
What she said. No, it's true. It's true. You know, it's the workout is provided and we are really there to instruct. We are there to guide you through and to give you some ideas to possibly inspire you to, you know, to get the maximum workout. And that's the whole point here, not to hurt you, but to build you up and get you stronger.
There's another piece to this, and that's that statins. So if you have patients who are on statins in your spin class,
oh boy!
So that we don't know how prevalent that is, but you know a lot of people get put on statins. Statins all by themselves can cause rhabdomyolysis.
Mm.
So if you then go ahead and do a really hard exercise class that you're not trained for, you're more likely to get rhabdomyolysis, and you're more likely to get rhabdomyolysis if you are fit and you're taking the statins. Like I said, alone can give you rhabdomyolysis.
Wow, wow! So you know there's a lot of factors involved here.
Yep.
definitely a lot of factors involved. So moving on, I have here a there's a piece here from, I believe this came out of Bicycling Magazine, and it's "Do This One Thing to Sprint Faster, Climb Better, and Descend Smoothly, and More." And it says here, 5 easy steps to improve your cycling and reap instant speed. Well, we are in a culture of speed. We do like to see what we can do to improve our fitness, to go faster and to go farther. And anyway, so, but I love the first one. I love 105. Sprint faster. Gear down a hair. Here we go. Okay. It's not about the big gears. One of the most common mistakes riders make when initiating their sprint is tossing it into a huge gear before they jump, which actually leads to a slower blast off than they get out of a lighter gear. And that's from John Verhul, head coach at JBV Coaching. The big resistance may feel powerful, but remember, power is force times velocity, and the second component is worth a lot. He says, most people accelerate better at a pedaling cadence of 100 RPMs than at 80 RPMs. Even muscular weightlifting track sprinters don't start a sprint at 75 or 80 RPMs, nor do fast road and criterium sprinters. So you want to practice this once a week. Perform 6 to 12 super short sprints, working on good form, hands in drops, elbows bent, butt back over the saddle to keep the weight centered over the bike. Keep training sprints to 10 seconds or roughly 15 to 20 pedal strokes, which is easier to count. That way you don't build up lactate, which is the whole point here. Take 2 to 3 minutes to recover between each sprint before to let you fully recharge your ATP and hit top power every time. Try starting in different gears. Try some seated to sit and spin. Try some standing. And perform some when you stand to accelerate for 10 pedal strokes and then sit to spin it out. So that, I saw this and I just went, yay, somebody said it. It's good. It's not about the big gear. It's about the leg speed. It's about turning the legs over. 80 RPMs is not going to make you faster. 100 RPMs is going to make you faster. So your comments, my dear?
He who spins the fastest is the fastest.
Is the fastest, right. Thank you, Joe. Yes, our friend Joe from New Jersey, who is a many-time national champion, road champion on his bicycle, and also a coach and does clinics. And so, anyway, yay, Joe. So, climb better. To climb a hill faster, you often have to start slower so you can ramp up your pace to get closer to the top instead of fading back into a grind. Exercising this discipline is nearly as hard as the hill itself for most riders, but it's well worth practicing. Just as with sprinting, the first step is starting in an easier gear. Punching a tall gear, no matter how good you feel at first, into a climb is a recipe for cooked legs. Yeah, otherwise known as attacking the bottom of the hill,
yeah.
I believe. Okay, click into a gear you can spin at least 70 RPMs and keep your effort level below threshold. Oof, it's hard to do at about a 6 effort level on a 1 to 10 basis. And as you work your way up, gradually tick up the pace, increasing your effort to a 7 and then to an 8. When the top is within sight, get out of the saddle and crank it over the top. How many times have you heard me say, do not attack the bottom of the hill?
Dancing three-quarter time.
Dancing three-quarter time, right. And Fran calls it dancing in three-quarter time.
Skip said that.
I say,
that's a big shout-out to Skip.
Oh, that's a shout-out to Skip. I say that you basically hold about a 75% of your maximum capacity as you're climbing the hill, 75% of the way up the hill, and then the last 25%, if you've got it, that's when you attack the hill. Because when you attack the hill at the bottom, you go anaerobic very quickly, and you end up gasping for air and going much, much slower up the hill because you basically burn all your matches at the bottom of the hill. If you attack the hill near the top and you do go anaerobic, and you will go anaerobic, so you'll really be pushing yourself over the threshold, you can recover right away because you're going over the top of the hill and down the other side. So your recovery is much quicker. And you're not trying to recover while still looking at another half a mile of hill in front of you. So that's a really, really simple thing, is to climb. It says here, climb better. I'm going to say climb smarter. So you want to be attacking. If you are going to attack a hill and use it to your advantage to make you stronger, then you want to do this by attacking the top of the hill, not the bottom of the hill. There are a few more things on here. Shift more seamlessly. You want to be careful about your shifting. You want to make sure that you shift before you're putting too much strain on the bike. You want to keep that leg speed up. We're going to talk about leg speed, leg speed, leg speed. The goal is to get your hands to shift in sync with what your legs need, and your brain knows is correct based on how you are, what you're seeing and how you're feeling. Practice, practice, practice. Find a rolling section of road and practice over and over shifting. Shifting smoothly to stay at a constant RPM when speeds vary widely. That's not necessarily your ultimate goal, but it's a good drill to learn in the skill of shifting at the right time so it becomes intuitive. There's more. Descend more smoothly. Here's a big one. Ironically, some of the best climbers lose most of their time on the descents because they never bother working on the downside. Obviously, if all descents were a perfectly straight line, it wouldn't be an issue. It's those corners that cause the quandary. To carve them more confidently, concentrate on one thing, your weight distribution. Put your inside hand on the drops and the foot on the outside foot down on the crank at 6 o'clock. Those two points are where 80% of your weight should be, with the remaining 20% on the saddle. Your position keeps enough weight in your front and rear tires to help them grip. If you want less weight in your saddle, then on the outside, then your outside pedal, because your leg is better at absorbing the little bumps and keeping the tires on the ground than your butt. So there's a good little thing. And brake smarter. Learning to scrub speed rather than treating your brakes like an on-off switch will go a long way in helping you maintain a brisker pace overall and, more importantly, ride more safely. Yeah, the brakes are not there to come to a screeching stop. I mean, yes, you can use them for that, but they're really there to control the speed, scrub the speed. This is an excellent, excellent tip right here. You want to, if you're jamming on the brakes when you're going into corners or just before you're going into corners, you're missing the point here. You need to learn how to read the corner better and learn how to practice your way through it. If you are unfamiliar with it, if you feel like you need some help with it, ask a seasoned cyclist who knows how to descend to ride behind you, not in front of you, but behind you, and give you the words of guidance as they tell you where to be in the road. Listen to them. They know what they're talking about. So these are, Breaking Smarter is another one. These will all help. I hope this will help you guys when you're out riding your bicycle the next time. And a great article here from Bicycling Magazine by Celine Yeager, who writes great articles. So we like Celine a lot. Anyway, we are going to, we're going to have to wrap this thing up. We're almost done. Look at this, just like that. So I just wanted to throw a couple of other little items in here, just so you know, going down the bottom of my list here. Remember that we have some events coming up. We have the new Ashford Metric Gravel Grinder on September 16th, 2017. I will have more information on that soon, because I believe we will have a couple of folks from Nearac Earth on the show to talk a little bit more about that. Jill, are you listening? Also, Hartford Riverfront Cyclocross. Yes, folks, it's cyclocross season. It is the first and the opener of the Connecticut Cyclocross Series. It is Saturday, September 9th in Riverfront Park in Hartford. The KMC Crossfest. Wait a minute, I missed one here. After that is the KMC Crossfest, which is September 28th through October 1st. It is a weekend of cyclocross. It is at the Thompson Speedway in Thompson, Connecticut. It's really cool. We'll talk more about it later. I have a guest coming on that will be talking about the the Builder's Ball, which is associated with it on the Friday evening of that particular event. Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross, another local event here, Saturday, October 7th. And more cyclocross, the Gloucester Grand Prix of Cross, October 14th and 15th. There's some really big cross events coming up, a lot of fun. There's a whole bunch. There's like eight now in the Connecticut series, so we have a lot of cyclocross here locally, which is cool, which is really, really nice to see. So lots of good stuff going on there. There is also a the Cycling Concepts Two Ferry Metric, but I couldn't pull the date on that. But I know it's a little bit later this year, and it is in September, I do believe. So there's another event for you. So there's lots of cycling going on. There's so much to see. The Great River Ride is coming up in October. Beautiful, beautiful century. Unbelievable New England views. So anyway, moving forward, my name is Peddlin' Ron. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, the lovely Fran Storch.
Yeah.
A show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. Remember, you can reach me by emailing to bicycletalk1@gmail.com. And you can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you'd like to contribute or be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Peddlin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS, Storrs.